Hello, once again, welcome to the Gratuitous Pausing Podcast. I'm your host, Alex Greyhawk.
And I'm your co-host, Jackson Eflin.
Thank you for joining us for episode 21 of our Disney Bracket. This week we will be discussing 1961's 101 Dalmatians, as well as 1999's Tarzan.
So, two talking animal movies?
Surprisingly similar films?
Yeah, pretty similar.
I also think that this week is going to be probably one of the best we've had of showing just how different storytelling and film structure comes over time in Hollywood.
Yeah.
Both these films are very good. 101 Dalmatians seated number two in our bracket, and Tarzan was the very tail end of the Disney Renaissance. So there's approximately 40 years of difference between these two films, and ideas about what makes a good movie for each of those time periods definitely show.
You also have, as usual, experimental animation stuff happening we can get into.
All right. Why don't we go ahead and hit our points from previous episodes on these two films?
Sure.
So, from episode 9, where we discussed 101 Dalmatians and Emperor's New Groove, with 101 Dalmatians, we felt that some of the TV scenes and the Twilight bark were a little bit drawn out and probably could have been trimmed down just a little bit to make the movie flow a little better. We also noticed that all of the songs are diegetic, and the movie has very strong songs because of it. We also noticed that the changes they made adapting this to a film from a book were probably for the best. Roger and Anita became much less bougie, and they consolidated a number of characters. We also talked about how good of a villain Cruella de Vil is. Her characterization, she has a villain song, but it's not even sung by her, as well as her smoke being part of her character design. We talked about the pretty decent diversity of character body types, both among men and women, as far as size, nose shape, and facial features. We talked about the backgrounds of the film and how full and interesting they were without being too jarring. They do interesting thing with the line work, but the colors are much more muted and everything kind of blends together. We also discussed a little bit how this was Disney's first contemporary animated film in that the film is set at the same time it was released, for the most part. However, that can lead to some hardships, like the use of British slang throughout the film can be somewhat hard to follow. But it also allows the use of in-universe television shows to establish some of the setting and add a lot to the film. We also talked about how Sergeant Tibbs is the best Disney cat. However, there's some fat shaming going on with Rolly that we felt was a little unnecessary and kind of crappy. And there's also a little bit of similar situation going on at the very beginning of the film where Pongo is kind of judging these women walking by outside. Neither of these things are that egregious, but could probably do with a second pass to improve them.
Meanwhile, with Tarzan, we had our first guest, Daniel Na, who, as a reminder, is the host of Audio Morph's cast and OK Crusader. He talked about how the animation is really incredible, especially Tarzan's movements, and got a bit into how someone definitely has a thing for Michelangelo, given how stacked everybody is. We talked about how both Tarzan and Clayton are very muscular, but in different ways, and how that explores different parts of their character. We talked about how Tarzan never finds out he avenged his parents, and that's kind of weird. We talked about how the film kind of skips over the colonial stuff from the books and how that's probably for the best. How there's kind of no way to win that, so they just kind of didn't. There's still issues there, but they're diluted severely. Because how the themes of adoption in the narrative are really powerful for some people, with Tarzan struggling to find his place in a family that was very different from him. We talked about how you and Daniel were huge fans of the Phil Collins songs. I was less impressed. We wonder why Tarzan has an American accent when he's learning how to speak English from English people. And then there are a lot of corpses. There's both parents, there's Sabor, and then there's Clayton. And how Tarzan probably could have tried harder to save Clayton. Just saying. Sips tea.
So, there's your previous Leons for this week. I think one of the biggest similarities between these two films is how prominent the music is. Music's not typically something that I pay much attention to in film, unless it's really, really good, or unless the film makes a big deal about it. And I think both those categories apply to both these films.
This is my second watch through Tarzan. Like, I hadn't seen it before a few weeks ago when we saw it for the podcast. And that I was kind of like, these songs are okay here. I'm really not a fan of the Phil Collins. I mean, the songs are good, but it doesn't sound like the jungle. There's probably a better way to put that, but the songs feel like they were pasted on top of the film from something else. Like, these songs already just grabbed them, as opposed to them being written to fit into the narrative.
I can see that perspective. I don't necessarily agree entirely. I think one of the reasons they chose Phil Collins is that he is specifically a drummer and percussion features heavily in all of the songs in the film. I think that kind of alludes to the jungle and more African music, considering how prominent percussion is in music of those cultures. But I can definitely see where you're coming from, that they don't flow as well as typical Disney fare. And I think part of the reason for that is that they're all montages. Almost none of the music is diegetic. The only exceptions are the very beginning of You'll Be in My Heart, as well as Mbop She Do.
What I couldn't help thinking of, it's kind of an almost dead meme at that point. It's the cowboy going. Over the cliffs in that one song. And you're wondering why there's this sky cowboy singing about the other sky cowboys in this weird way. That's the impression I got, that like Phil Collins is off to the left singing about what's happening on screen and everybody's trying to ignore him because they're like, oh god, Phil Collins singing at us again. That's maybe not fair, but it feels disconnected.
So you weren't a fan of Phil Collins. What about the music from 101?
Oh man, I love that. A part of it is that they're using the music of the time. The music feels like the time that it's taking place because it's made about a contemporary narrative, and then the film looks like this time period looks in my head, and it all flows really well. There's this one really small part. I'm not sure when this came into the film. I'm not sure if it was part of the original theatrical experience back in the 60s or not, but I was watching it on headphones for this time through, and there's a bit where I was playing the trombone at Cruella de Vil through the floorboards trying to get her to go away, and as we switch from the camera being up in the attic to the camera downstairs, the sound switches from being surround sound to only coming out of the right ear. And that's a really specific little tweak to make it feel like it's coming from somewhere else that I really appreciated. Also, just like the way that the music is being composed through the narrative is really cool. Disney usually has the music just kind of come out of nowhere, so having a narrative about somebody actually writing music was really cool. That said, it really only has one song that we just get a lot of variations on, and then background music, so it doesn't have the three or four songs from Tarzan. So if you're looking at just sheer quantity.
Yeah, we get Cruella de Vil, which pops up three or so times throughout the film. We have the Canine Crunchies jingle, which...
yeah, you can't see me rolling my eyes, but...
And then we have the outro song of Dalmatian Plantation.
Yeah, which is kind of a nothing song.
I like it. It's not bad, but it's no Cruella de Vil.
No. Although, to be fair, Cruella de Vil is an amazing song.
It is. Since we're speaking about Cruella already, it's weird how similar the villains in both these films are.
They both don't regard animals having any intrinsic value. Or people, really, in Cruella's case. I'm really glad I have the subtitles on when I was watching Tarzan this time around, because there's a bit when we're first meeting Clay, and I think the first time he shows up on screen, you don't really hear what he's saying because of the rustling of the bushes, but if you're reading the subs, you can see that he's saying that he's talking about his time hunting up down the Zambezi River, and he says, as he walks into the frame,
"That's when I knew I was born for Africa, and Africa was created from..."
Wow. Wow, dude. Wow. It's such an amazingly thorough establishing character line just in that one moment. He's the epitome of the entitled white hunter guy.
And then we have Cruella, who is old money and is entitled in that way and doesn't understand at all how Roger and Anita, who are not struggling, but are... lower income after their marriage and after moving to a larger home from their apartments. And she can't understand why they won't just take the money for the puppies. The scene where Roger stands up to Cruella is excellent in a variety of ways. Partially because he is standing up to her, but you can also understand that he's literally petrified. He can barely move. And on Trevola's previous visit, she actually compares Roger to Galahad.
And poor Roger is your bold and fearless Sir Galahad.
And that comparison is now coming back to bite her in the butt.
So I spent an hour and a half trying to figure out why she mentioned Galahad, because I didn't know if like Galahad was particularly popular at the time, if there was some reason why that would be the knight you would reference, because I don't know who Galahad is without thinking about it. Who is Galahad? What's his role in the myth?
I couldn't tell you off the top of my head.
He's the son of Lancelot, he's the most noble knight, and he's the only one who can actually receive the Grail and gets teleported to heaven. I couldn't find anything, I think it just that was someone that sounded good. To be fair, it's pretty accurate, actually. Galahad is this guy who's just incredibly good and pure, and Roger is in fact incredibly good and pure. And Roger's arc is really good in the movie, because he starts off being kind of hazy, not really connected to the world, just all in his music, and then he becomes this family man who cares about his family and his pets, and standing up to Cruella, and goes from just sort of this passive-aggressive to actually telling her no.
You're not getting one. Not one. And that's final.
And it's a really good arc. It mostly is done by the middle of the film, but to be fair, he's mostly out of the film by then, so he has a complete arc. It's just, it's not as obvious because we're not used to the way the film is structured.
I also really love how much of a goofball he is.
Yes. Speaking of goofballs, there's an amazing bit where all the puppies are watching television, and one of them says,
"Old Thunderbolt's the greatest dog in the whole world."
And another puppy says,
"No dog's better than Dad."
And the Pongo has this smug-ass grin. Immediately following that, one of the puppies uses some foul language, you know, 60s foul language, and then Perdita's just like,
"Why, Patch, where did you ever hear such talk? Certainly not from your mother."
And then Pongo's smile sort of slowly fades. Pongo and all the dogs in general, especially Pongo, is a really layered character that I really believe in.
I know we said that TV scene drags on a little bit, but giving it a second watch through, I really wouldn't cut much, maybe some of the actual TV scenes, but that scene establishes so much character between the puppies and their parents. Like, a great thing at the very end, Pongo is talking to Perdita, and in that way that parents do with young children, will spell out things to their spouse in order to not excite the children, because hopefully they don't know how to spell. And of course, doesn't work here.
And yeah, I have the same thought when I was going to say, oh yeah, I get why this is here. This is where we learn about these puppies and who they are as people. And that makes us care about them. So when they're in distress, it's not just the abstract idea of puppies in distress. It's these characters we care about. Admittedly, not all the characters really get to do that much. There's like Rolly and Lucky who really come back more. The rest are kind of just background lines and I don't remember much about the rest of them.
Yeah, there's Rolly, Lucky, Patch, and then there's one female puppy whose name I don't believe actually gets mentioned, who has a few lines, and that's about it.
So that scene does a good job of establishing that these characters exist and that they're worth caring about. The rest of the film doesn't always come through with that, but I get what it's doing, and it does a pretty good job of it, and it's not a bad scene. It has some really good jokes, and I'm like, aw.
In contrast, I wish that we spent a little bit more time with some of the other gorillas in Tarzan's family group. We get Kerchak, Kala, Turk, then the rest. There's Turk's mom and Turk's two friends, and I don't think any of them really get names in the film.
I don't think so. It might be like in passing or in the credits, but they're also not really characters beyond just being, I guess, 80s bullies. It's not a bad thing, per se, but it does make the film feel less textured, and I'm comparing it to the ancestor scene in Mulan, where you have all these ancestors who only have one or two lines each, but they're very vibrant, and you kind of get a sense that they're their own person. They have their own personality, but it's not focusing on them because they're not the main character.
Mm-hmm. Well, we can't all be acupuncturists!
That said, Turk is amazing. Watching through this time, I was like, yeah, Turk, give me more Turk. She's having a lot of fun, and she has a motor mouth thing going on that I really appreciate with characters in comedy, and it works really well. It makes her feel vibrant in a film that could use more vibrancy sometimes.
There's also the interesting stuff going on with Turk and her presentation of gender. She's voiced by Rosie O'Donnell, so she has this very butch demeanor, and how she interacts with Tarzan and her friends and pretty much everyone just kind of really solidifies that. And you don't get that archetype very often in Disney films.
No. And I really like that you have her juxtaposed with Tantor, who's he's a soft boy. He's very in touch with his feelings. He's very sensitive. And I like that you have the hard woman, sensitive guy. It's a nice contrast. And I guess we get that with Felix and Calhoun in Wreck-It Ralph. That's 20 years later. Or 15, 10, 8, 47. I'm not a math major. You don't see it very often is what I'm saying. And it's a good archetype. Especially since she actually gets that really good moment towards the end where she's being all tough and saying,
"Yeah, well, good riddance, or I don't need you, huh? Go on, get out of here, Bubba, you. You ingrate, you bald, ingrate, go out and rot for all I care, go." What are you looking at?
And Tantor says,
"I'm gonna miss him too."
And then it's just like this really like heartwarming, it's only there for a moment, but it still feels real. I'm like, yeah, this interiority, good.
So we've covered two of the biggest comparisons. Let's go ahead and dive into the third one, and that's the parent-child relationships. Mm. Both of these films have a strong focus on those two things, but they're coming at them from very different points of view. On one hand, we have Tarzan, whose relationship with his parents is strained at various points of the film. We have his birth parents, who die when he's an infant. Then we have his adoptive mother, Kala. Great mom, however, there's always this underlying feeling that Tarzan has that he doesn't quite belong. He's not exactly like his mom. That's not really helped by Kerchak refusing to acknowledge him as his son or really even a member of his family unit.
And on the one hand, the scene where Tarzan is covering himself with mud to make himself look more gorilla-like, and Kala doesn't really care about what he looks like. She cares that he has a heartbeat just like her, and that's what matters. It's really sweet, and it's really cool, and I appreciate that. But on the flip side, I feel like Kala could have done better about telling him where he came from and what happened. I know that talking to your kids about adoption is really a complicated subject, and I don't want to say that one way of doing it is always the right way, but I feel like given what he was going through, having more of a sense of where he came from and why things are the way they are might have helped him earlier than when he's about to leave to England.
Yeah, she probably at some point should have taken him there earlier than she did.
And we mentioned this last time, it's weird that I don't think Tarzan knows that Sabor killed his parents and that he avenged his parents' death. I feel like it's something you should bring up. You have this really fairly significant action that has no real bearing on Tarzan's interiority, and it should.
All of that is also contrasted with the relationship that Jane and her father have, that throughout the entire film is depicted as incredibly healthy.
Yeah.
And also really progressive for the time period that this movie takes place in. Archimedes is always encouraging his daughter to do all these difficult, exciting, interesting things, and is not holding her back because of her gender.
He's very curious about the natural world, especially gorillas, and he's so thrilled that she is too. And it's really cool. They just have this thing to bond over. It doesn't feel like he's treating her like a son or like, I don't know where that was going. Got that bit, yeah.
I think what you're trying to get is he doesn't treat her as an extension of his legacy, just another person who is as thrilled about him about these things.
They're friends in their curiosity. There's no subordinates happening. And I also like that it's a little on the nose, but there's the bit where Archimedes is like,
"But you love him."
Which I appreciate. Mm. And it's cool that he's like, "Hey, I want you to make these choices for your happiness, not for what has propriety."
Yeah, what society expects of you.
Mm-hmm.
And he feels so strongly about it. It's like, why would I go back to England? The gorillas that I love studying are here, and my daughter is going to be here. Why?
Also, if I go to England and I have to middle manage the Prime Minister of Great Britain and Northern Ireland for the rest of my life, and it's going to be very stressful. No one's seen Yes Minister, but you should all watch it. It's amazing. It's so good. Sir Nigel Hawthorne, who plays Archimedes Potter, is a delight in that. Circling back to the whole thing with Sabor, does Cruella actually get caught? Does anybody know that she stole a clutch of puppies?
I believe that we see it in like a newspaper article towards end of the film. They do that a few times. Like they have a newspaper article about the puppies being stolen and whatnot. And it makes sense for the time period that that's where big news would break.
Oh, sure. Speaking of which, I freeze frame through a lot of those, and there's some real history happening in those pages. Like, there was a bit where there's several articles referencing the rocket protests that were happening in 1958 onward, where people were really up in arms about nuclear arms and were protesting the UK having them. And this was a big thing, and so, like, it's being preserved in the pages of this cartoon.
That's really neat.
Yeah. There's probably other stuff that I couldn't find as easily, but yeah, there's definitely some stuff that was, like, a real thing happening. And I like that it placed itself in a very specific time period. As a quick sidebar, there's a funny bit where, at the very end, Anita asks,
"Well, where did they all come from?"
And Rogers goes,
"Oh, Pongo, you old rascal!"
Pongo does that big grin again, like, A thing I really like about 101 Dalmatians is, we talked about this before, that it's really cool, there's a sense of community justice, but going further than that, almost everybody that the Pongos encounter, Pongo and Perdita, everybody that they encounter says, "Who could do this? This is horrible. How can this happen? I can't believe this." The film establishes that this villain is aberrant. She is not normal. This is not to be expected. This is outside of what should be. It's not the inevitability of the rich preying on the poor or the disenfranchised. It's this person is unusual, and the world shouldn't work like this, and most people in the world are good. And I really like that. A lot of movies, especially kids' movies, miss out on talking about whether or not evil is inevitable and inherent in the world, or just an unusual thing that crops up every now and again. And I appreciate that this film says, no, this is not how things are, not how things should be.
They do a really great job of establishing that. There's this scene after Cruella's first visit where Perdita is hiding underneath a cabinet in the basement, and Pongo goes down and tries to console her and...
"Oh, don't worry, Perdy. They're on to her. Nothing's going to happen to our puppies."
And Perdy is wondering why she even wants the puppies, and she says,
"What does she want with them? She can't possibly love them."
And that, in addition to the song that Roger sang right before Cruella visited, is kind of like the 1-2 punch of, this is everything about how the world feels about Cruella. Although the film does not quite do that as much with Jasper and Horace.
Nope, they're just poor.
They're kind of in it for a paycheck, although there are a few times where Horace is like,
"I don't like it, Jasper. One more pinch and they'll throw the keys away."
Unfortunately, Jasper keeps dragging him along.
Jasper has this very strong Count Olaf vibe with the drinking and the being very spindly.
I can see it.
Honestly, the bit where they're trying to get all the puppies out and Jasper is drunkenly throwing wine bottles at Sergeant Tibbs is kind of scary, honestly. It's a very mundane sort of evil, the mean drunk. It's also weird seeing drunkenness in a Disney movie, because, I mean, nowadays that doesn't really happen as much. I mean, it might still be a thing, but you know how characters getting wasted in Disney movies?
Same with cigarettes. I mean, we talked about how many people smoke in this film, protagonists and villains alike.
Yeah. We talked about how Cruella's smoke follows her like a sentient being or something, but Roger has that one thing where he's just puffing on his pipe. That's sort of what he's doing.
Yeah, he does it in the park. He also does it during the scene with him and Pongo waiting in the kitchen while Perdy is giving birth.
Whereas in the present day, you can't even have dark anti-heroes smoking on screen. There's an episode of Legend of Tomorrow that has Constantine, who is a heavy smoker in the comics, and it's kind of a plot point that every time he tries to light up, something will stop him from doing so, because they can't show that.
I'm pretty sure, like, it all comes down to ratings. I believe that smoking in a film, I believe, gets you moved to an R rating, and then on TV gets you moved to an MA rating.
Wow.
I mean, it makes sense considering the amount of pushback that, especially during the 90s, that there was against smoking, especially depicting smoking as cool for kids. Unfortunately, there's quite a bit of a resurgence for that with various e-cigarette products, but that is beyond the scope of this podcast.
Right. Speaking of cool, Tarzan wants to be seen as cool by Kolchak, but I don't get why. I mean, apart from just, like, wanting father's approval, Kolchak never does anything to make me go, ah, yes, I would want him to care about me as a person. He's just always sort of a jerk to Tarzan, and it seems like Tarzan's need to be accepted by him is not something he should need. I feel like in a modern version of this, he might realize, oh, I don't actually need you, Kolchak. I'm going to go not care about your opinions, Dad.
So you keep referring to him as Kolchak when his name is Kerchak, and I can only think of Kolchak the Night Stalker. I'm like, no.
I mean, I feel like that would improve the movie a little bit. It's just, they're all still gorillas, but their leader is Kolchak the Night Stalker. I feel like Kerchak is not that well worked in terms of why he really matters to Tarzan.
Kerchak is very archetypical of the distant, aloof, unapproving father. Especially during this time period, that archetype was present in a lot of films and sitcoms. And there were a lot of narratives about older boys, young men, attempting to prove their worth to their fathers. And there are very different ways that those narratives would resolve. Again, sometimes it's, well, I don't really need your approval. Or sometimes it's eventually winning their approval for various things. But I wouldn't say it's out of place for the time period.
Oh, no. I just think it could have been handled better. Like, when Kerchak is angry at Tarzan for bringing the humans to their glade, whatever, it seems like part of why Tarzan is upset about the dangers posed by the situation are because he made Kerchak unhappy about him instead of, oh, no, I have brought danger and ruin to my people, initially, before stuff goes bad.
I think part of it is just Kerchak's like a 600 to 800 pound gorilla. Part of the issue that Kerchak has with Tarzan towards the middle and end of the film is Kerchak realizes that, no, Tarzan is stronger than me. He can take me, and that means that he should be leader of the group. And that is an issue for Kerchak for many reasons, partially because, well, I wasn't the best father to him, so I don't know how I'm going to fall if he attempts to usurp the throne, so to speak, from me. There's also the fact that Kerchak still views Tarzan as an outsider. He's not sure how well Tarzan is going to protect and provide for the group if Tarzan takes power.
Even though clearly everybody should vote for Turk 2020. But then, instead of having a peaceful resolution where they work through those issues and toxic masculinity involved in that, Kerchak just dies at the end. And we don't really get a good resolution of that. We just get Tarzan being king now.
Although, if Kerchak had not died, Tarzan probably would have just left with Jane and Archimedes.
That's true. Last time, we talked about how I thought the Twilight Bark scene was too long. Although, I thought it might feel differently if I knew where it was going, because I hadn't seen 100 Dalmatians for a parsec. So I didn't know what the point of the Twilight Bark was. Having seen the second time, knowing where it's going, I still think it's too long. It's not awful, but once we get out of the city and we have the Twilight Bark happening back and forth between the floppy-eared dog with the goose and then the military outpost, it turns into like, oh, it's wacky that they're repeating things wrong, and that sort of drives the momentum into the ground, and I thought the scene could have been used better somewhere else. That said, we do get Sergeant Tibbs, who I love dearly, and his beleaguered sigh after someone thanks him for going into Hell Hall twice. He's like,
oh, nothing at all. All in the line of duty.
That's right, sir. Routine.
I get what every part of that scene is trying to do, but I definitely think there's some fat that can be trimmed. I mean, we have the establishing shot with the small dog and the Great Dane, hearing from Pago and Party and then spreading the word. And then a lot of while they're in the city is used to give cameos to some of the dogs that they designed earlier in the film, like when Pongo was looking out the window, or do little callbacks to characters from Lady and the Tramp. They get outside the city and it's the Bloodhound and the Colonel communicating. And most of that scene is dedicated to establishing the relationship between the Captain, the Colonel, and Sergeant Tibbs. And again, I know what that scene is trying to do, and it does a really good job of it, but it can be condensed a little bit.
There's sort of one joke with the Colonel, and they just do the same joke over and over, and it doesn't work super well.
He's this old, incompetent dog.
He's the leader elephant from Jungle Book.
Yeah, he's just Colonel Hottie all over again,
yeah.
Except more incompetent.
Yeah. That said, we do get to see all those different dogs we saw in the opening and where they live, what they're doing, and I like that they get to have their own lives and be their own people in their own narratives. There's sort of just happen to be intersecting with us. We get to see a little bit more of their world.
It also allows the animators, again, to play around with the backgrounds that we complimented them on and really set the time period.
The dogs having interiority in that bit get to the heart of a problem I have with Tarzan. So with Pongo and with Roger and all these other characters, I feel like they're very rich and vibrant, and they're interesting in this narrative, but if you had another story about them, I would probably be interested in that too. They feel like they are characters who have goals and personality beyond this story. I don't necessarily feel that with Tarzan as much, because his story is about him trying to figure out where he belongs and who he is to this group. But by the end of the story, he has done that, and he has learned all that he needs to learn about himself. And because he's a relatively quiet character who expresses himself through motion, we don't get as much personality out of him, and I'm less engaged with him as a character. Turk is fine, Jane is fine, Archimedes is fine, but I don't care as much about Tarzan himself, and as the central character, I think that's kind of a problem.
I don't necessarily disagree. Tarzan is much more stoic of a character, and again, expresses himself through motion, action, and quite often jokes and pranks. And yeah, that is kind of a detriment to the film. I think another thing is just the equal footing that the animal characters in 101 Dalmatians have compared to the human characters. Every time that Roger is talking with Pongo, it's not necessarily just a man talking to his dog, but there's this sense of equality in their relationship that Roger, for the most part, views Pongo as an equal, not a subordinate.
Yeah.
While that is the case for a number of the human characters in Tarzan, they don't do a great job of showing it. And that, again, partially comes back to the fact that most of the gorillas and other animal characters, A, don't interact with any human character really outside of Tarzan because there's the language barrier, and also don't really have that much personality to express themselves.
Mm-hmm. They're also not on screen at the same time a lot. It's mostly Tarzan interacting with the gorillas and then going to interact with the humans in the camp, and very rarely do the two halves meet.
Two worlds, one family.
Trust yourself, let fate design and guide you along. I don't... They're not catchy! I don't feel it. I'm not feeling it.
I also think that the pacing issues that 101 Dalmatian suffers from are not present in Tarzan. And on the other hand, the pacing issues that are present in 101 Dalmatians, I really don't feel that Tarzan has. I think Tarzan does a much better job of filling up its time with interesting things going on, whether it be action sequences or the musical montages. I don't feel that certain scenes drag in Tarzan the way I felt that they did in 101.
I agree with you there, but at the same time, I think Tarzan has other pacing troubles. The opening montage goes by really fast, and then we get Tarzan as baby sequence, Kala being like, no, I'm raising this kid, he's my surrogate son now, it's fine. Then we have a scene where Tarzan steals the hair from the elephants, and I get what it's doing and why it's here, but it's Tarzan's motivation to become who he becomes, and it doesn't tell us a lot about who he is as an adult. That could have been accelerated and more time given to the opening montage of things happening, so we care more about the parents and their absence. Then we get the whole, like, killing of Sabor stuff. This is all its own movie, and then we start a whole new movie about Tarzan meeting Jane. And these two parts are connected by an emotional through line, but they're not necessarily connected by an action through line. Jane and her family aren't in the narrative at all, and I don't necessarily feel the absence of them because Tarzan is doing such a good job aping his family. Mm. And again, Tarzan defeating the monster that killed his parents is sort of a act one afterthought thing that doesn't interact with the rest of the world that much. And I think there's maybe something like a pacing problem. It's a structural problem that I don't necessarily know where the story's going the first time through.
That's valid. I think that mostly comes down to attempting to adapt a series of books into a single film.
Whereas with Dalmatians, Cruella is introduced pretty early on and she stays the main antagonist, and the what's she doing with the puppies thing is introduced pretty early on, and we just have that ongoing tension that builds up. And I think that handles its antagonist better as opposed to Sabor and then Clayton.
Tarzan is much more structured around Tarzan's emotional journey as opposed to any external force. There are external forces that move that plot, but unless you're invested in that emotional development, there's not a solid through line for you to follow.
And while I think the emotional through line is well done, I didn't connect to it super a lot. I'm not adopted and I never had that need to have approval or fit in with my peers as a assigned male at birth white person. So, you know, it might work a lot better for other people, and that's fine.
Okay. think it's about that time. Let's go ahead and vote for what moves on.
I think I'm slightly more excited about 101 Dalmatians.
I think I am too. It's incredibly close. I think mostly what edges 101 out is that it doesn't really have any problematic stuff going on with it. Whereas with this watch through, I was seeing the bits of the colonialism from the source material creep through a bit more. So again, I'm going to give it to 101 Dalmatians.
And like we've said before, it's not that Tarzan is a bad movie. It's just that here and there, there's a few things that don't work quite as well overall as the things that work in 101. I think Tarzan's really good every once in a while, whereas Dalmatian's a little bit more of an easy watch. Tarzan is an emotional journey that you're going through, which is really good, but I'm not necessarily always in a place to go through that emotional journey.
Whereas 101 Dalmatians is just so wholesome, and it pretty much always makes me feel good after watching it.
Yeah.
So, we have 101 Dalmatians moving on to round three. Next week, we will be talking about Hercules, as well as Lilo and Stitch.
Oh, darn it. They're so fun.
Lilo and Stitch keeps getting these really tough matchups. It already beat out Aladdin to make it to round two.
And Hercules doesn't have the, like, issues of racism that pull Aladdin back a lot.
Yeah. We'll see how difficult that matchup is next week. And if you want to make sure to catch that, you can go ahead and follow us on Facebook and Twitter and Podbean.
Meanwhile, I have an announcement, actually. So my friend Mike Noel from over at the Equalizers and I are starting a limited run podcast, short season thing, and we'll see how it goes.
So miniseries?
Yeah, a miniseries. Thank you. It's called A Study in Granada. We are watching the Jeremy Brett and David Burke Sherlock Holmes series from Granada Television that aired in the 80s and 90s. And we're doing a read-along watch-along with the original Conan Doyle stories. So the first episode is out now. And if you want to listen to it, cool. Maybe go read A Scandal in Bohemia first so you're not spoiled on the ending.
And we will make sure to provide links to that in the episode description below. Once again, thank you for listening to the Gratuitous Pausing Podcast. We hope you tune in next time.